From the studios of WHQR Wilmington, WHQR Public Radio presents our weekly talk show, Coastline. Our topic today is exploring our world. I'm Cleve Callison, sitting in today for Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. And whether you're listening on 91.3 in Wilmington, 98.9 in Myrtle Beach, 94.1 in Lumberton, or on our HD1 channel, or streaming online from anywhere in the world, let's say, for example, Austria, we invite you to join us for a discussion with our guest, anthropologist and explorer Julian Monroe Fisher. Later in this hour, we'll be joined by writer Philip Girard, who is professor of creative writing at UNCW and the author of Down the Wild Cape Fear. I invite you to contact us if you have a question for Monroe Fisher in this next segment. You can call us at 910-343-1138 or send an email to coastline@whqr.org, or you can follow us on Twitter at @CoastlineHQR. Now, last week I introduced today's guest to the Wilmington Rotary Club as their speaker that day. I recall then watching Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom on television, especially the parts where Marlon Perkins says something like, "While Jim Fowler is busy wrestling with the alligator, I'll be here in the production tent enjoying a gin and tonic." Well, like Jim Fowler, Julian Monroe Fisher is the real deal, although I don't know if he's ever wrestled an alligator. Maybe we'll find out. He is an anthropologist, a TED Talks speaker, an ethnographic filmmaker, a published author, a fellow with the Royal Geographical Society in London, an international fellow with the Explorers Club in New York, and a member of the American Anthropological Association. And above all, he's an explorer. Between 2007 and 2014, Monroe conducted six Explorers Club flag-sanctioned research expeditions to the African continent. He is originally from the Carolinas and is a graduate of Appalachian State University in Boone. Monroe currently lives with his family here in Wilmington. In July 2013, National Geographic magazine highlighted his work in Africa, establishing the Sir Samuel and Lady Florence Baker Historical Trail, the first so-called through hiking trail on the African continent. And in January 2015, CNN referred to Monroe's Baker Trail as, quote, "one of the world's most amazing long-distance trails," unquote. Monroe Fisher, welcome to Coastline.
Cleve, thank you for having me today. It's certainly a pleasure.
Now, I gave you a big build-up there, and let's try to fill that out a little bit. I wanted to talk to you in this first segment of the program, and let me remind people that phone number for your calls is 910-343-1138. I want to talk to you a little bit about your African experiences, and then the next segment we'll talk about your newest project, which is called Carolina Rivers. But how did you get started with these explorations in Africa?
It goes back to, I guess, 1996. I reached a point in my life. My father was dying of cancer. I was sitting there on the 11 o'clock at night till 7 o'clock shift, taking a break from my job, which at the time was in the hospitality business, working for managing hotels, sales and marketing for properties for different brands, ski resort business. And as I would sit there at night listening to him, as he was facing the end of his life, he kept saying, if I had it all to do over again, I'd get out and travel more, I'd see more of the world, and I'd write a book. So when my father did pass away, I decided it was time to get back into life. Although I was making great money, I enjoyed my job, it just was leaving a big hole in me. And so I snapped, I guess is the best way of putting it. I sold everything I owned. I ended up with about $6,000 in cash after I paid off a lot of debt. I looked up. I had frequent flyer points from corporate life. So I contacted U.S. Airways and said, how far south can I go on my frequent flyer points? And they said, Cancun, Mexico is about as far as those points are going to take you. So before I left, I said, I went to a friend of mine in the radio business, the notorious John Boy and Billy radio show out of Charlotte, pitched him an idea. I said, what about this? Here's a gringo getting ready to head south. I'm going to head for the Panama Canal overland. What about if I call in to your listeners each week and tell them what it's like on the trail, what I've done each week? The rules of engagement with the radio station were simple. No four-letter words. We're not going to pay you. You'll be freelance.
So far, so good. I'm checking these off myself as you're going down.
I'd fit right in, wouldn't I? Yeah. Right? Public radio. And I took off. I got to Cancun. I got on buses. The first call in I did for John Boy and Billy, I was on a place called the beach in Playa del Carmen, Mexico, south of Cancun. And I talked about what it was like to be in Mexico on Halloween. And my story involved watching a guy get stabbed on the beach, the whole atmosphere during Halloween down there. It's the dead are coming up. It was a brilliant, brilliant time. I enjoyed it. The next week, I called in from the Mosquito Coast of Honduras, making good time going south. I talked about what it was like to be so remote in the bush country of Honduras and not being able to speak the language. They went into their Christmas break. After the break, they said, this has taken off. And I did that for 7 years, traveled around the globe 2.5 times, calling in, gained some sponsorship from some local companies here in North Carolina. And then about 2003, obviously the world had changed with 9/11. And the radio business had certainly changed, and certainly commercial radio with John Boy and Billy. They had gone from one station in 1995, 96, to over 100 by 2003. They were corporately owned. My reports were always live. They had come to the conclusion that they could still trust me with the content, but they needed to put a time delay into it. So we started doing the delay. That was working well after 9/11. But then they started getting dictates from above, the corporate ladder, about where I could go and what I could talk about. And so it just seemed a proper time that we kind of separated our ways. That's when I dusted off my anthropology degree from Appalachian State University. I called a professor of mine, and he said, it's like this. Somebody your age that wants to get back in anthropology, you have two choices. You can either go back to school to get the PhD that I never got, or you could go out into the world and practice personal anthropology. And so being lazy by nature, I decided to go and do the personal anthropology, which I had already traveled into Africa. I had a love affair growing with the continent. And so that's when I started focusing on historical explorers, historical expeditions, and that's led me back time and time again. I'll return again in the I spent January and February there this year. I'll be back there again in January and February, March of next year.
Wow. We're talking with Julian Monroe Fisher. Monroe is an explorer. He's going to be talking to us about his project Carolina Rivers in a few minutes, and talking now about Africa. And you talked about explorers. By the way, for you to join the conversation, that number is 910-343-1138. You talked about explorers in Africa, and most people, I guess, know the story, or at least the myth of Stanley and Livingston, you know, Dr. Livingston, I presume, and that sort of thing. What is the Sir Samuel and Lady Florence Baker? What's their connection with Africa?
Well, the Victorian Age explorers, and at the period of time that I really focus upon is the late 1800s, a lot of explorers were going up the Nile River, to determine the source of the River Nile. And two people who financed themselves was Sir Samuel White Baker, a UK British explorer. His wife, Florence, he had actually purchased her in a slave market in the Middle East. Preferably,
was she an English woman?
No, she was. And interesting, the relationship I have, my wife being Viennese, Lady Florence was actually from Hungary.
She ended up in a slave market.
That's where he found her, and she was at the time being bid upon by a wealthy Turkish gentleman. And so Sir Samuel bought her away from the bidding process. He was his wife had died at the time. He had some children, young adult children. And he fell in love with Florence, which would create a problem for him years later when the Queen of England didn't like the fact that he had been living with Florence, had actually taken her off to Africa, and they weren't married. It almost he almost didn't get knighted because of that. But the explorers would go upriver looking for the source of the Nile. And Baker and Lady Florence, with his own money, traveled up the Nile, got as far as Juba is the modern-day name of the capital of South Sudan. It was Gondokoro at the time. And so they were there with a boat, sitting there wondering what they were going to be able to get out of exploring the heart, central of Africa. About that time, two explorers who are credited, Speke and Grant, British explorers who are credited with finding the true source of the River Nile, Lake Victoria, they came stumbling out of the bush after 2 years. They're set like an oasis, Baker and Lady Florence on a boat. Baker said, look, the guy that the Royal Geographical Society paid to be here to meet you, he's off hunting elephants. I'm here. Here's my boat. You can go back home. Go back to your life. And Speke said, well, that's just beyond our expectations. You know, they were tattered. They'd been in the bush for close to two years. And Baker said, is there anything left on the laurel for me in regards to this source of the Nile story? And Speke said, yes, I've got this map. We weren't able to explore it. And that lake was Lake Albert. And he named it. And
in honor of the Queen's consort,
right,
Albert. Yeah. That's fascinating. We'll get back to some more adventures in Africa with our guest, explorer Monroe Fisher, in just a moment after we take a short break. You're listening to Coastline here on WHQR. I'm Cleve Callison, sitting in today for Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. If you'd like to join our conversation, we have a couple of ways for you to do that. You can call us at area code 910-343-1138. You can also send an email to coastline@whqr.org, and you can follow us on Twitter @CoastlineHQR. We'll be back after a break with more from explorer Monroe Fisher, and Philip Gerard will be joining us to talk about his book, Down the Wild Cape Fear, and we'll find out about Carolina Rivers. That's all coming up in about 90 seconds. We'll be right back. From the studios of WHQR Wilmington, WHQR Public Radio presents our weekly talk show, Coastline. Our topic today is exploring our world. I'm Cleve Callison, sitting in today for Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. We invite you to join us as we continue our discussion with our guest, anthropologist and explorer, Julian Monroe Fisher. Before the break, we were talking about Monroe's adventures in Africa, and we'll pick up that conversation in a little bit. But in this segment of the program, we're going to turn our attention to his newest project, which is called Carolina Rivers. And joining us for this segment of Coastline is writer Philip Gerard, professor of creative writing at UNCW, of course, a commentator here at WHQR, and he's the author of Down the Wild Cape Fear. Thank you for joining us, Philip.
Hey, my great pleasure, Cleve.
Glad you're here. And invite our listeners to contact us if you have a question for either of our guests today, either Monroe Fisher or Philip Gerard. You can call us at 910-343-1138, or you can send an email to coastline@whqr.org, and you can follow us on Twitter @CoastlineHQR. Let me start, Monroe, with you. Your project now is Carolina Rivers. Where did that idea come from?
Carolina Rivers, Education and Preservation Through Exploration, is something that had kind of been sitting in the back of my mind for years. And it really amounts to not only here in North Carolina or the Carolinas, but around the globe. We're constantly engaged with waterways, with rivers. We're either following them along in a car, we're flying over them in an airplane or a helicopter, or we're traveling over them in a car. And it was certainly one of the things in Philip's book, which I luckily have a copy with right here, Down the Wild Cape Fear. It was one point in there that really jumped out at me. For too many of us, and I'm quoting out of the book, for too many of us, the river is invisible. And I think that amounts to what I was realizing in my life. And although I still have a passion, I still do a great deal of work in Africa, and I'll continue to do that as long as the Africans allow me to venture out that way. But living here now in Wilmington, more and more I'm seeing a couple of things. I'm seeing the rivers. I'm hearing more stories about the challenges environmentally that our rivers are facing. And at the same time, I'm fortunate enough to have two wonderful, bright children that are constantly on either the iPad or they're on the mobile phones. And we, as adults, I don't think I'm really setting the best standard for them because I'm also on the iPads, on the mobile phones, on my computer too long. So I decided, one, to get out and learn more about our world, to learn more about the Carolina Rivers, and at the same time create a living tool that I can give to our schools across both South Carolina and North Carolina that they can use as teaching tools to get the people engaged, to get the kids engaged at an early age to go out and explore their world.
Well, your website, I believe, is carolinarivers.com, and in there you talk about this. This is a two-year project, right?
Right.
You plan to float down all or part of 32 different rivers in North and South Carolina. And I know you started back, was it in April, you started with French Broad River in Asheville. Is that right?
Yes, and I'll probably, it's a wonderful trip. We did 100 miles on the French Broad River. I should have known growing up in Banner Elk, North Carolina, that you need to wait to go to the mountains to jump in the rivers. I probably took a little bit, you know, thought about doing it
down. A little too soon.
A little too soon, but we had a stellar time up there. The project is not, and I try to tell people that every time the question about Carolina Rivers comes up, it's not a source to see attempt at rivers. I'm not going out there to break a record. I'm not trying to be the first that has done something. What I'm trying to do is different from what a lot of the shows that we see about rivers. You know, the team, they get the money together, they get the gear together, they go to the river. They get on the river. They go down river. They camp. Some people try to do it in one long shot. Some people are smart, and they break it up into sections. What I'm trying to do is I'm going to do sections on the river, but I'm also going to be walking and hiking long sections along the river. Because the last thing I want to do is become, here's this guy who steps into the limelight with our rivers and tells us the problems with the rivers. I want the voice of the rivers to be the local people that I encounter in the different communities because they're the people who can better judge the water quality, the quality of life, what those rivers face, the benefits to us all of engaging ourselves with the rivers.
And you're planning to, I believe when you spoke to me earlier, you said you're planning to end with the Cape Fear River next year, 2016.
That's my goal is, you know, we've got so many beautiful rivers. And again, you know, I want to encourage everyone. I'm not that young any longer. I've just recently turned 60. I was born in 1955. I have never been a kayaker. I had to learn how to do this. And I had a local gentleman, Don Hardy, that took me out and taught me how to paddle on the Black River right here in eastern North Carolina. And one of you talk about jumping into the water and getting used to it. At that time last spring, the water levels were too low. So what do we have to do? We've got to get out and portage through the Three Sisters Swamp. And you'd hear these noises, plop, plop, plop. And I said, later in the day, I said, Don, what was that noise? And he says, oh, don't worry about that. Those are the snakes falling out of the trees.
Oh, man. Okay. Well, let's find out some more about that later on. But let's, again, welcome Philip to the show. And Philip, Julian has talked about, Monroe has talked about how he got started with this. How did you get started with your book about Down the Wild Cape Fear?
Well, I had done a TV show with UNC TV, 20 years ago, and we'd gone down the river as a way of looking at certain environmental problems in North Carolina, and I was so fascinated by the river, and there was so much that we couldn't fit into even a one-hour documentary for television that I promised myself I'd write the book, and I just never got around to it. And then I was in a position where I was chairing a department. I couldn't afford to go off and spend 6 months somewhere. And so I used, you know, what I think of as Tracy Kidder's rule. He said, you know, if you draw a line, a big circle around where you are, where you can drive 45 minutes in any direction, you have your life's work to write about. And I thought, you know, that river is sitting right there.
Yeah.
And so it was kind of a no-brainer to get back on the river and spend the time I wanted to and really explore the things I wanted to find out about it.
If you have a question for Monroe Fisher or Philip Girard, please give us a call, 910-343-1138, or you can send an email to coastline@ at WHQR.org. Well, did it take you 6 months to explore the river and write the book?
It took far longer than that.
Really?
Because I did it in segments, and I got out. I went back and interviewed people. I walked it. I drove up. I went in different seasons and saw parts of it. I, too, did some portaging through the Three Sisters. And what you realize, among other things, is, you know, it's a wilderness. It may be right off the foot of Water Street, but you get 6 feet out into the water, and there are sturgeon there that are as long as a boat. There are things living in the water, and it isn't just the water, it's the sky way over it. There are many complicated levels of that the birds occupy. The river creates its own weather by virtue of the fact that water cools and warms at different rates than the land around it. The swampland on the Brunswick County side or the trails, all that's part of the river basin and the river system. And so it turns out to be a really complicated, fascinating, living thing. And it takes a long time to kind of get that. And once you do and you kind of let yourself fall into it, it becomes something very special.
How much of it did you float down? Did you go the whole length of it?
I didn't. We ended up – I took companions. I was smart enough to realize I wanted a biologist and a photographer and some guides and people of that sort. So actually canoed from the Mermaid Point, which is where the Deep and the Hawk come together. I did that part of it alone and actually did that last. And then I took three companions, two canoes worth, from Buckhorn Dam down to the put-in below Fayetteville. And we did all that paddling, and then from there we used small boats, and then finally out in the estuary did larger boats. But it was a little, you kind of rocks and rolls out there a bit, so you have a little bit harder time in a kayak. Mm-hmm. But the idea was to be, and then of course paddled the various other creeks, Town Creek and Shelter Creek and Island Creek and all the ones that kind of feed into the Cape of the Black River, going up the Northeast Branch a bit. So it's an endless web of waterways, thousands of miles literally of water to paddle.
Yeah. And you were in a canoe, whereas Monroe is doing this with kayak. Is that right?
I'm doing all. I'm doing SUP. I'm doing kayaks. But so far, and one of my sponsors is not quite happy about that, we've been in canoes. And the canoes allowed us up on the French Broad. It was truly like a Lewis and Clark approach. We got all of our gear, all of our food, everything, and set out from the headwaters at Rosamond, North Carolina. And for 10 days, we were on that river, living on that river. And as Philip just mentioned, these are living waterways. There is absolutely no telling what you're going to see out there from that vantage point of water level. And, you know, we're out there with the daunting task of trying to film it. You could do a lot with a GoPro, but if you want to get a little bit higher quality of imagery, you've got to take a bigger, better camera. And, you know, every time I see a snag or a down tree, my blood pressure goes straight up because now I've got to get myself in and out of the boat around the tree, and I'm not really good with a chainsaw like some of the people I'm traveling with. And then I've also got to get this camera safely of the boat, back in the boat, over the tree. So, you know, it's challenging out there, but that's what life's about.
Yeah. And the river's never the same thing from one minute to the next, let alone one day to the next. The water level rises. Things that weren't in the river before are now squarely across your path in the river. An animal that wasn't there before, like an alligator, for example, is now squarely where you want to go. So it is an ever-changing. You're never in the same river from minute to minute.
Did you actually encounter some alligators on your trip?
Not on that particular trip, but on side trips up Town Creek. And actually, well, Ethan, who is our expedition guide, he was out with his little sailboat in the middle of the main channel down here off of Wilmington one day, and an alligator was swimming behind his boat.
Wow.
And, yeah.
So. You're listening to our talk show, Coastline, from WHQR. We'd like to invite you to join the conversation. Our phone number is 910-343-1138. Our email address is coastline@whqr.org. And our guests are Monroe Fisher and Philip Girard. We do have a question here, an email question from Jack Spruill. And, Jack, this is addressed to you, Julian. It says, apparently you plan to explore and document four rivers that connect with the Albemarle Sound. I guess he's been looking at your website. As you probably well know, there are seven more rivers that connect directly with the Albemarle, together with significant creeks and many swamps. The Albemarle is itself the largest freshwater sound in the world, and geologists say that it's an ancient river by itself. What do you think that the Albemarle and its system of rivers, creeks, and swamps, why do you think they do not get more attention in North Carolina in view of its very special geological significance, natural history, cultural history, and beauty?
A great question. One of the things I've had a hard time doing is keeping it manageable at 32 rivers.
Yeah.
You know, I get emails almost every day, anytime people visit the website, with suggestions. And our list of 32 rivers evolves. We might drop some. We might increase the rivers. What I'm trying to focus a lot on are the blackwater sections and the headwater sections. A lot of our rivers are dammed up. There is a movement across the country with American rivers to try to remove a lot of these dams. But what I'm finding, if I can just get going and have a goal of 32, I think that's a lot more than a lot of people are attempting right here in the Carolinas. He's got my attention. I'm going to let him email me and see about those other waterways that he suggests. It gets down, and I'm sure Philip would say the same, it gets down to the local knowledge. You know, the people that live out there can tell you, when I've gone out on the Black River with Don and we've weaved our way through, if you don't go with a local guide, you'll still be out there. It's just, as Philip mentioned, every turn, every moment you're on the river, it's ever-changing. And to get deep into this wilderness, I've been in the heart of Africa and have not been so confounded, if you will, as I have been on some of the rivers that I'm getting out on. The Lumber River, we've done the French, and we've completed the North Carolina sections of the Lumber River. And without Al Pittman, who's a local guy up in Lumberton, I would still be up there. I could not find my way through that. Your GPS is not going to help you. I don't take satellite phones to Africa.
I mean, just passing over it on 74, it just looks more like a swamp than a river. Well, so I guess there must be some motion on the water.
There's some motion, but I mean, to my disbelief, cell phone coverage is not a given out on the Lumber River.
Oh, no kidding.
It's also true that we don't use rivers the way they were used 100 years ago. So 100 years ago, everything along the Cape Fear was named. There were something like 85 steamboat landings between here and Fayetteville, and everybody knew them. Even though they had no road signs, we don't do that anymore. And so those pass into disuse. And we think of them either as a picturesque thing that we drive over on a bridge, or if you're one of the few people that go out in a canoe or kayak, you appreciate it. But they're not the roadways that they were. And people knew them like they know the exits from I-95 or I-40 back in the day.
You mean they knew exactly
where they were on the river.
Off? And
if you were courting a girl, you would get in your boat and you would know exactly where to go and which creek to get off of and what dirt road led to her house. And if you were going to bring your goods to market from, Keenansville, you'd know exactly how to get them on the Northeast Branch, bring them down to Wilmington, and exactly where the landing was, and you would know every turn in the dark. We don't do that anymore, and so that knowledge has fallen by the wayside.
What did you notice? You said this started from a project, Philip Girard, that you started 20 years or so ago. Did you notice any differences between then and now in terms of environment or other ways that we're treating the rivers?
Two huge differences. And bear in mind, the Cape Fear has been engineered from the seaway, from the buoy, all the way up. So that to get to Mermaid Point, Mermaid Point's now underwater behind a dam. It used to be a beach. And all along the way, there are three locks and dams. Well, the biggest things are, one, there's no longer any significant commercial boat traffic to Fayetteville. That's finally gone. Uh-huh. And so very shortly, I imagine the Corps will stop dredging that portion if they have it already. The other thing is that Lock and Dam Number 1 now has the Rock Arch Rapids, which takes the place of the old dam, and it allows the fish that have to get up the sturgeon, the stripers in particular, to get up and spawn above the salt water, which encroaches all the way up there because of the deepening of the channel. So that's great news, and I think there are plans afoot to get rid of the other two dams and to put rapids so the fish can get all the way up the river finally.
What about things like just litter or other kinds of things? Are we doing a better job with that than 20 years ago?
It's not litter. What it is are concentrated feeding operations. So we put a moratorium on the hog farm operations after Hurricane Fran and the disastrous spills that they had. Some were grandfathered in, and so we've added to that, but now there are concentrated chicken operations. And so there's always something that's putting pressure on the river, and that's you know, because of the volume of it and the kind of chemical makeup of it, including arsenic and things that we really don't want in our drinking water, that has become a focus of river watch groups and so forth.
Mm-hmm. How far, I'm still not clear about how far up the river you went. I mean, did you go all the way to
200 miles
to Guilford County and then
200 miles? It's the Haw and the Deep. It comes out of Jordan Lake, basically, and they meet above a place called – they meet at Mermaid Point above Buckhorn Dam, right where Chatham and Lee County are, is where I got in the water and came down from there. So it's about 200 miles to the sea, depending on exactly where you measure the sea buoy from.
Okay. All right. You're listening to Coastline on WHQR. We've got a couple of minutes left before we have to take another break. Our phone number is 910-343-1138. If you have a question for Monroe Fisher about his African expeditions, which we'll talk about some more in the next segment, or about his project Carolina Rivers, please get in touch with us. Our email address is coastline@whqr.org. And was any of this, Philip, any of this trip down the river by yourself, or were you always with a party of people?
I took the last part of it, which was actually the beginning of the river. I went from the confluence at Mermaid Point down to Buckhorn Dam, which is something on the order of 7 miles or thereabouts. And that was in a kayak alone. It was kind of like the last bit that I allowed myself to savor. I had originally planned to start there, and for various reasons it didn't work out that way. And it turned out to be kind of the perfect ending because I ended up being able to bring the kayak in at the dam where we had left from. And so it was really a circular journey as well as a journey down the river.
You completed it.
Yeah.
Very good. Thank you for being here and for talking with us about your book, which is called Down the Wild Cape Fear. And we've got a copy of it right here. Monroe is looking at it. Glad to have that. Philip, thank you very much. Philip Gerard is, of course, professor of creative writing at UNCW. He's a commentator at WHQR. And he's the author of several books, including that one, Down the Wild Cape Fear. And Monroe, we'll get back to your African expedition as soon as Philip autographs that book for you. And we'll be back with the next segment of today's Coastline. Our phone number again, 910-343-1138. Or send an email to coastline@whqr.org. We've got about 20 minutes left in this program, so get your questions in for Monroe Fisher about our topic today, exploring our world. We'll be back. Welcome back to Coastline here on WHQR. I'm Cleve Callison, sitting in today for Rachel Lewis Hilburn. And I hope you'll join us for this program as we continue our conversation with Julian Monroe Fisher. Monroe is an explorer and an anthropologist who has traveled in lots of places around our world. He was telling us in this last segment about his new project called Carolina Rivers, and we want to go back and pick up some more of the story about his adventures in Africa. If you have a question for Monroe, please give us a call at 910-343-1138. We've got about 18 minutes left in this show. 910-343-1138, or send us an email to coastline@whqr.org. Here's a tweet that just came in a minute or so ago, from Seacoast Advantage, the folks there. And this is actually a comment for Philip Gerard, and their comment is, "We don't use rivers the same anymore. We used to know them as well as we know modern-day roads, and that knowledge has decreased," and that was one of the topics that Philip was talking about that was reflected in his book about how we just we're not so familiar with them except just in passing, driving over them and seeing them from a great distance.
You know, I see that a lot, the difference between here, living in the United States, and my travels to Africa. The rivers and the waterways play such an important part of the life for an African. It's either the lake that they're fishing in, it's the rivers that they have to go across to see relatives. That's the difference. We don't feel like we need our rivers anymore.
Well, we just take water for granted. You know, all you have to do is turn on the tap and there it is.
That's it.
And you see pictures from Africa of people who spend a great part of their day being concerned about, you know, where am I going to get, not only where am I going to get food today, but where am I going to get water today? And sometimes walking long distances carrying jugs of water to get their daily water ration.
I go, for the last two years, I've traveled into South Sudan. The war has been raging there since December 2013. I have befriended people in local villages. You have 10,000 people that are living off of one bore well, one hole in the ground with a pump that's providing the water for 10,000 people. And you have women and children that are, as we speak, either going to the water hole or coming back, and it's constant all day long. You'll see a water well anywhere you're traveling in Africa, and there's usually a long line of empty jerry cans, plastic containers, that they are in queue waiting to get water to take home to provide drinking water, cooking water, bathing water. Of course, they don't really take it back for bathing. They go to the river to do the bathing.
Right. You're listening to Coastline here on WHQR. Our guest is Monroe Fisher. I'm Cleve Callison. Our phone number, 910-343-1138. And Monroe, a while back we were just starting to talk about your work with the Sir Samuel and Lady Florence Baker Historical Trail, and you talked a little bit about who they were, and this trail is named for them. And how far across does it go? What is the length of that trail that you've been on?
It's about 800 kilometers. It's roughly 500 miles.
Uh-huh.
It starts in Juba, South Sudan, and it ends up at Lake Albert, in a place called Baker's View, the location where Sir Samuel White Baker first arrived to Lake Albert and saw the expanse of water in front of him, and that's Baker's View. It's got historical locations all along the trail where significant things happened to the Bakers, how they encountered the local indigenous populations, the local kingdoms, if you will. I'm happy that National Geographic embraced it.
They named it as one of the world's 20 best hikes a couple of years ago.
And CNN did it back in January of this year, 2015. I have to say, now that I've got the airwaves, you have to approach this particular trail with extreme caution.
It's a dangerous part of the world right now.
I get emails every day, and the one thing I stress, this is an evolving project. I hope that in 20 years from now that it'll be like going out and engaging the Appalachian Trail, because the sections that the trail walks through, if you will, one of the countries is still in war. It's a full-blown war going on. And in northern Uganda, that's where the Lord's Resistance Army, the LRA, Joseph Kony, developed child soldiers. So a lot of these communities have been devastated for close to a half a century. And until they can get the peace within their communities, these trails are just dream trails.
Uh-huh. Well, I wanted to ask you about that. You were telling me before the show started that you consider Uganda to be a fairly safe place to visit, but yet, as you talked about, there's the Lord's Resistance Army. You yourself were arrested in Uganda.
This year, I've been going to Uganda. I know a lot of your listeners might be surprised, but I do self-driving when I go to Uganda. I feel that comfortable with the countryside. That means I'm renting a car. I'm driving myself. I'm not on a tour. I don't have a guide. I'm filling up the vehicle with fuel, and I'm going out into the bush. The situation in Uganda is ever-changing, as Africa is, but I do put Uganda as one of, to me, the safest locations. I like South Sudan, but when I go there, the handlers and the logistics people that I'm working with, we travel into the countryside. I travel with six local people. Each of them are carrying an AK-47, automatic weapon, and when I'm with them, they give me one in case. And luckily, I have not run into those kind of problems. But then again, you know, I think safety and security is relative. You know, you can go out in parts of our local community here and at the wrong time of the day, running into the wrong person, you could get yourself in a lot of trouble. This past year, earlier this year in Uganda, I got arrested for trying to take a photograph of the wrong house. You know, you always say
– like a powerful person's house or something like
that? It turned out to be about the second most powerful person in that country of Uganda. They just were curious. I had stopped by three times to get permission, and the homeowner was never there. I didn't realize there was going to be an issue. They were never there. Okay, I'm not going to get a photograph of that house until 11 o'clock at night, one evening at my hotel in town. Knock, 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 11 o'clock. I wake up, and there's six police officers there ready for me to explain what am I doing, why am I trying to take that picture. The other instance this year, I got robbed. I was had entered a private sugar plantation to a private club. I was swimming in a beautiful pool. I was having a wonderful Sunday afternoon, and somewhere within the facilities of the changing room, I had a wad of money that was sewn into my clothing that walked away out of my clothing. Yeah. So it can, you know, I felt like it was probably long overdue. That happening, I'll still go back to Uganda. I'm still planning a trip next year. I think one of the bigger issues that I faced this year going to Africa, everybody said Ebola. It's
right.
the Ebola. And what I try to come back and explain to people is, look at a map. Where I was in Uganda would be like saying, okay, the Ebola breakout is in Los Angeles, and I'm exploring in Wilmington. It's thousands of miles away. The outbreak was in West Africa. I was more in Central to East Africa. So it's not always, you know, most of the countries I've traveled to, there is a United States State Department traveler's alert warning telling us not to go there, like traveling into the Congo. I've traveled into the Congo several times. I've been very fortunate, and I've met absolutely some of the most caring and wonderful people I've met.
We have a tweet here, and I'm not all that familiar with the conventions. Nope, we're not going to do that. Okay, all right, very good. We were mentioned in a tweet, but I've been waved away from that. Okay. But I'm talking with Monroe Fisher here. You talked earlier about you wanted to change your life at some point, and you decided to become an explorer. Has it worked out the way you had hoped? Have you seen those kinds of things that you had wished that you would see? And what is left? What are the other things that you want to do?
You know, that's a great question. I have been absolutely the most fortunate person. This part of this chapter in my life that's been running now for, I guess, since about 1995, 96, it has brought love to me. I found my soulmate out there traveling on a boat from Belize to Honduras, a two-hour boat ride, nothing to do with Gilligan. We have two beautiful children. We have a very good life here in Wilmington. I still get to go out. I've realized that when I got out of college with my BA, and I stress this to anyone out there, university level right now, I made one mistake. To be an anthropologist and to be respected more so, you need those three letters after your name.
PhD.
Instead, I have four letters after mine. I have an FRGS for Fellow of the Royal Geographical Society and a Fellow with the Explorers Club. But that is great in exploration, but it does not allow me to get into classrooms to engage future anthropologists. Mm-hmm. If I had it to do over, I'd go back and do that. I would have pursued it. But then again, where would I be in life? Would I have met the love of my life? Where would I be? Would I be sitting here today?
Right. You might be sitting in a classroom grading papers.
And regretting that I had ever gone after the PhD. Yeah. I got that. But I've learned a lot. It's becoming a younger man, younger woman, business out there. Exploration in this day and age, it's business. Back when you know, I was growing up, you had Marlon Perkins. I happen to know Jim Fowler. But I also know Jim's son, who's making a pretty big name in exploration for himself.
Well, let me just ask, we just have a few minutes left, but How are expeditions funded now, and how are they going to be funded in the future? I know you've got a lot of corporate sponsors lined up for Carolina Rivers. Is that kind of the way things are going for this sort of thing, or that governments are pulling back and geographical societies and others are pulling back?
All of those mentioned are definitely pulling back. It's becoming more and more competitive. Everybody out there wants to be the next Bear Grylls. Everybody, the formula, that, and the British have been doing this since the early age of exploration. You go do the work, you come back with a salty, either a frozen beard or a sunburn. You've got that iconic photograph of it's at the end of the planet. Then you come back and you write the book, you get the lecture deal. Now they've taken it into TV and movies. So it's getting harder and harder to finance it. It's more and more competitive. But that's the whole idea with Carolina Rivers. You don't have to go to Africa, Asia, or Antarctica to be an explorer. You can do it right here in your own backyard.
Well, you had mentioned something. I think it must be on your website that you have something with a television network, Out Wild, or something like that. Is that one of the projects that you're working on as well?
Out Wild is a unique group. They have the approach that they felt that National Geographic Television has become too focused on prison shows, car shows. It's gotten away
from... There's a lot of extreme things.
Extreme things.
Yeah.
To talk about a river, now they want you to go jump off a waterfall in a small kayak. I'm not jumping off waterfalls with a small kayak. But the Outwild TV, they approached me back in 2013, and what a great deal they offered me. They came to me and said this: we would like to teach you how to be a filmmaker, to do it the way we want it done. You tell us how much it costs for you to go to Africa to do whatever you do when you go to Africa, and we want you to go do that, film it, come back, and we're going to edit the film into a project. To say the least, it was probably the easiest expedition I've ever financed, to be able to get the money, get the funding all in place up front. It was a great opportunity. I went off, gathered great film content. It now sits at the corporate offices of Outwild TV in edit, and I look forward to seeing the final product someday. What I've done with Carolina Rivers...
Sounds a little nebulous. I mean, are they actually going to finish up the editing process?
They've the person that was the explorer, if you will, that was two before me, his film has just now been completed, and he did that expedition in winter 2013. 2 years plus later, he's getting his done this year. There's hope down the line.
Okay.
But now what we're doing with Carolina Rivers, we have our own production company. So we have our own film gear. We're out filming it ourselves,
so
editing it.
So you're documenting all this on video?
Yes, absolutely.
And doing any audio stuff or just video?
Well, yes, I've been doing audio. I wanted to pitch it your way. You know how that goes.
Okay. Well, you've been listening to our weekly talk show, Coastline. Our topic today has been exploring our world, and our guest has been Monroe Fisher. I'm Cleve Callison. I'm sitting in today for Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. And I want to thank you for joining me today as we have talked with our guest. And I wanted to read something, Monroe, that I saw on your website, and I want to kind of close with this quote where you say, "To be an explorer, you don't have to travel to Africa, Asia, Antarctica, or other far-off-the-beaten-path distant lands. All you really have to do is find the time to walk outside your front door with curious eyes. In a time, you will see your world for the first time." So I think that's a nice sentiment and a fitting way to end our little mini expedition with you. So thank you so much for being with us here today on Coastline.
Thank you, Cleve. It's been a pleasure.
Also, our guest in this hour was Philip Girard, professor of creative writing at UNCW and the author of Down the Wild Cape Fear. Join us next week at this time for Coastline with Rachel Lewis-Hilburn, who will be back in this seat. Coastline's producer is Isabel Shepherd, who was also our Twitter wrangler today, and Ken Campbell was our audio engineer today. We hope that you'll listen to Coastline each week, Wednesday at 12:06 after our midday interview, and of course we do have a repeat of this program on Saturdays at 1 o'clock, and you can also download it as a podcast from our website, whqr.org, and we will have audio from this on our website fairly soon after this program is over. Again, thank you for joining us today. Thanks again, Monroe. We'll see everybody next week for Coastline here on WHQR.
Good afternoon. It's a minute before 1 o'clock. Stay tuned for Here and Now. It's coming up in just a moment on HQR News at 91.3 FM. Corporate support on WHQR is a great way to recognize your business or organization. WHQR welcomes Trolley Stop and Johnston Architects as our newest underwriters. To find out how your business or organization can support WHQR, email us at underwriting@whqr.org. This is WHQR Wilmington, 91.3 FM, serving Myrtle Beach at 98.9 on Translator W255BC and Lumberton at 94.1 on Translator W231AB. It's 1 o'clock.